Hi, everybody. Thanks for coming. I'm Marla Cohn. I'm editor-in-chief of Environmental Health News. And I've been a journalist for 30-some years. Started out, most of that was spent at newspapers. And now I'm at a publication that aggregates all the environmental news, plus we do our own journalism, foundation-funded, sort of a new wave of journalism given what's happened to mainstream media. I've covered specifically environmental health probably for 20 years. Coming from the Los Angeles area, I focused largely on air quality. And when I first started out, everybody was talking about things like benzene, carcinogens. But we've certainly evolved from there. We're not just talking about chemicals that might cause cancer anymore. We're talking about chemicals that disrupt hormones, that cause, you know, some fetal issues. They might reduce IQ. There's such a range of effects now that chemicals seem to have in animal studies as well as some human studies. So we're here to talk about environmental chemicals and diseases, and we're going to focus on two of them, which maybe you haven't written about or heard much about, obesity and diabetes. But we can also talk about, if you have questions about things like cancer and neurodevelopmental effects, that types of things, we might be able to address those as well. Just as an introduction, why diabetes, why obesity? Well, obviously, these are epidemic proportions in our society. And most people just talk about diet and lifestyle. But there could also be environmental connections as well. Worldwide, 220 million people and growing to 360 million have diabetes. And as much as 30% of that is not accounted for by body fat, by what it seems like dietary issues. Almost 34% of adults are obese in the U.S., 17% of children, and that's growing too. And what we've seen from some of the data, from animal studies as well as some human studies, is that there's a variety, an array of chemicals that might influence these types of problems. I'll give you sort of the shorthand list. PCBs, some pesticides, BPA, TBT, soybean formula, there's been some human studies, maternal smoking, phthalates, HCB, which is a pesticide that's no longer produced in this country, and DDT, another one. So you can see it's sort of the usual offenders when it comes to environmental health, but now we're looking at a whole new suite of possible effects. And I can tell you there's been very little coverage of these types of environmental issues. So I encourage you to take them on. They're not easy to cover, but they're so important, and they're very cutting edge. So we have two speakers here. We have Dr. Bloomberg from UC Irvine, and we have Dr. Thayer from NIEHS, National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences. And I think we'll start out with Bruce.
Yes. Thank you, Marla. So I have a pretty extensive handout. I'm not going to go through all of that and put you to sleep with lots of scientific details. I think what the main message I'd like to convey today is what we commonly hear about the causes of obesity in the U.S. are overly simplistic and probably much less than the whole story. So we hear diet and exercise. Diet and exercise are obviously important. I would never say otherwise. But there are numerous studies out there showing that diet and exercise are insufficient, right? That, of course, you can eat yourself into being obese, but why is it that 35% of Americans are obese? No one wants to be obese except for the one lady who's trying to set the world's record. I heard about she's shooting for 1,600 pounds. God knows why, but that's her goal. But aside from her, I think no one wants to be obese. And if it were a simple matter of balancing the caloric checkbook such that the calories out equal the calories in, it would be no problem. There are other factors. One of the factors which is worked on in my lab are chemicals in the environment. So the particular chemical that we're working on mostly is called tributyl tin. which was formerly used in anti-fouling paints on ship hulls, so it contaminates seafood. It's also found in polyvinyl chloride plastics and a variety of other sources. Its use has been phased out and replaced with actually a worse chemical called triphenyltin, which is a common thing that happens. We get rid of one chemical, we replace it with a similar one that hasn't been proven yet to have the same effects. So, as Marla said, these chemicals, many of the endocrine-disrupting chemicals, work on hormone receptors. And the hormone receptor that tributyltin works through is a receptor with a horrible name, peroxisome proliferator activated receptor gamma. You can call it PPAR gamma. And the reason that's important is because this receptor is the master regulator of development of fat cells in your body. So if you express this receptor in a cell, that cell becomes a pre-fat cell. And if you activate it, then it becomes a fat cell. And if you have a fat cell which expresses the receptor and you activate it, you put more fat in the cell. So this is a very key player. And tributyltin is a very good activator of this receptor. So what we found in our animal models is that when we feed mice with tributyltin prenatally, so when we give a pregnant mouse tributyltin, the pups that were exposed at 8 to 12 weeks of age will be heavier than animals that were not exposed. And that's an example of what we call developmental programming. So we've altered the physiology of these animals such that later in life, despite normal food and normal access to exercise, they get slightly fatter. And that's important because we all know people who can eat everything in sight and who don't gain weight. And we all know people, and we often think of them as ourselves, who eat one donut and gain a pound. So there are metabolic differences among humans and certainly among animals. So what we believe is that exposure to this class of environmental chemicals is changing metabolism such that it makes these animals more likely to gain weight. It predisposes them to make more and bigger fat cells. And the insidious thing is that this was just a maternal exposure, right? So these animals were exposed when they were in utero, when they were still inside their moms, and then never again. So it caused a permanent effect. And we don't know to what extent that happens in humans, but there's no reason to believe that you would get that effect in an animal but not in a human, since the receptor is essentially the same. And I think I'm going to leave it there, and I'll be happy to answer any and all questions that you have.
So I think basically what you're saying, has there been any human studies at all looking at TBT and obesity?
There is almost no studies showing levels of tributyltin in humans.
So there's
a hand over here already.
So it's really hard to... We'll limit it to... We'll come back to the audience questions. I just want to prompt a few.
So there are no studies measuring tributyltin in humans. We've done a similar experiment kind of accidentally. So there's a diabetes drug called Avandia, which activates PPAR gamma. And that drug makes people get fat. So here we have a chemical that activates the same receptor. You would expect the same effect. Right? A drug activates a receptor, people get fat. You would expect that a chemical that activates the same receptor gives the same effect. And there are probably a half a dozen chemicals that we know about that activate PPAR gamma. So all of those should behave in the same way.
And is there any difference in the human metabolism and the animal model metabolism that might mean there's not a human effect?
None that we know of. There's always a possibility, but I wouldn't bet that that's the case.
Okay. All right. After there.
Okay. Well, thank you, Bruce, for that introduction to the topic, and also, as always, you're a hard act to follow. But I wanted to just throw out a few additional scary statistics beyond what Marla said. So 45%, that's the estimated number of people in the U.S. who have either diabetes or prediabetes. And this data comes from the Center for Disease Control, where they've actually measured, they've taken measurements of fasting blood glucose or done glucose tolerance test on a survey that's designed to be representative. So about 11.5% of people have diabetes. About 30% of them don't know they have it. But about 35% of people have prediabetes. So this would be where they have an impaired fasting glucose or glucose tolerance level, but not quite at the diagnostic threshold for diabetes. So a huge problem. And as Marla said, we know that overweight and obese is a real risk factor for diabetes, about 70% accounting for it. But that leaves about 30% unaccounted for by body weight. So it's huge when you couple that with just the sheer number of people affected in the U.S. and abroad. And so this has been an emerging issue, looking at sort of non-traditional risk factors, including environmental chemicals. And over the past 10 years, especially the past 5 years, there's just been this flurry of new data. And it's really, it's a very legitimate research area. It's acknowledged in the Presidential Task Force on Childhood Obesity, the NIH Strategic Plan on Obesity, the strategic plan from the NIH Institute that focuses on diabetes, NIDDK. And so we've known it's this emerging body of literature. And what we did at the National Toxicology Program, which is where I work, it's headquartered at the NIHS, is to try to basically go through this exercise of amassing all this data that's been generated and trying to sort through and see what we know, what we don't know, and then think strategically about trying to craft a research agenda. So at the end of the day, we poured through what were literally thousands of studies. And we did this workshop in January of this year. We compiled about 500 pages of sort of technical white page documentation trying to summarize all this literature. And we convened a group of experts, including Bruce, so people who had knowledge of the experiments of environmental chemicals and obesity and diabetes, as well as scientists who maybe had never studied an environmental chemical but were experts in the field of diabetes and obesity. And we sat them together for about 2.5 days and asked them to sort of critically review this literature that was out there. And so what we found was that there was real biological plausibility for a role of the environmental chemicals in both of these health conditions. And that was based on looking at studies in humans, and I'll come back to that, as well as animal studies. So the work of Bruce, very, very elegant, very well-designed animal studies on tributyl-10, but also there were other chemicals that there was very intriguing animal data for, and mechanistic data. And by that I mean that what we found was when you look at some of the biological processes that are involved in diabetes and obesity, we found that a much larger number than we expected of environmental chemicals seem to affect cellular targets that are relevant for those biological processes. And so for us in toxicology, you have to understand that diabetes and obesity have not been health effects that we've ever really looked at before. And so this is the first time that we really sort of dug down and tried to sort of, at least at the mechanistic level, come up with chemicals that we think, oh, yeah, maybe we should look in animal models. Maybe we should try to look in human studies for these kind of associations. When we looked at the human studies, probably the strongest pattern was maternal smoking during pregnancy. So there were about 70 human studies. Many of them were prospective, so a very sort of strong experimental design. And almost all of them are reporting significant risk of childhood overweight or obesity if mom smoked. So many of these studies tried to control for a lot of the obvious lifestyle factors, junk food consumption, how much did mom weigh, and the unadjusted and the adjusted risk estimates didn't change that much, suggesting that it wasn't due to that.
How big of an increase generally did you see in the mothers who smoked?
I think it probably from maybe up to two. So risk estimates of 20%, maybe sort of a doubling, but not. I would say that it was a very consistent pattern in terms of being as strong a risk factor as inactivity. No, but a consistent one.
But so up to twice the risk.
Right, but for us. The telling part, I mean, clearly this is smoking. So this is not a new public health message. We know smoking is bad. Nobody encourages smoking during pregnancy. But what it told us is that there was real biological plausibility that an environmental factor could be a risk factor for childhood obesity. And this was really strengthened when we looked at the animal studies, so the experimental studies where you don't have to deal with all those messy lifestyle factors. What we saw is that animals that were treated with nicotine as fetuses, so mom was treated with nicotine, those animals were larger or they had sort of fat depots that were larger in adult life. So very consistent. So that was pretty surprising how sort of strong the data was to us. And then you have Bruce's story with Betel-10, sort of another very plausible developmental obesogen. A follow-up to the lack of human data, one of the things that we're doing to sort of address the research needs is we're trying to measure organotins in a sample of Danish women who are in a pregnancy study with the goal of trying to look at body weight in their babies. So we're trying to get the data. So for diabetes, when we looked at the human studies, when you look at arsenic, there's actually a very positive association with arsenic, especially in areas with high arsenic in the drinking water, so like Taiwan or Bangladesh. Again, when you look at sort of the factors that you might look at and thinking about whether you might not believe that association, a lot of those were considered, but at the end of the day, it felt like there was an association. Not quite as consistent when you look in the low to moderate exposure regions like here or Mexico, but some of the more recent studies that really had better measures of diabetes were a little bit more suggestive. So I think we're going to see a lot of research in arsenic. One last one would be sort of the associations with persistent organic pollutants, so PCB, DDT, DDE, trans-nonochloridane. The organochlorines, those showed, when you look in the human studies, fairly consistent positive associations. Certainly lots of research needs to sort of address the causality of it. It's not a literature that's really evolved at the animal data, so we don't have a lot of leverage there to try to better interpret the human findings. But that was the other one that I think we're really interested in trying to better understand that association.
One thing I want to point out is we still have very high exposures to some of these pollutants, even if they are no longer in production. PCBs, you know, we all know the story of the Hudson River probably and some of the Great Lakes. There's still elements of the population that are highly exposed to some of these organochlorines, PCBs. And then we have sort of the newer ones like the phthalates and things like that are still in consumer products. And you mentioned arsenic. So I just wanted to point out that there are many areas throughout this country that have high arsenic in their water supply, and they're spread out nationally. I just did a story on private water wells, and arsenic was one of the biggest offenders. So what you could do is you could go to a USGS map and look at your particular town or your state, and you could see, oh, there's high arsenic in this area. So you could go and look at what the arsenic levels are and then write stories about the health effects, including what we're talking about today. One question that I had, you said 30% are not accounted for by body weight. Do we have any idea, is most of that genetic? Do we have any sense of how much of that might be environmental exposure?
I mean, a lot of that, trying to find out sort of the contribution of X factor to disease is really, you know, you almost have to take those numbers with a grain of salt, because it's almost impossible to sort of tease out in these very complex diseases what contribution a single factor is. But Bruce, you can correct me if I'm wrong. I think people are sort of more and more accepting that just genetics alone is sort of not accounting for either of these health conditions as much as people might have expected at one time.
That's quite correct. And it's actually the case that if you consider human disease as a whole, so non-infectious disease, something between 5% and 30% of those diseases are explained by genetic factors. Think about that. We think about person has a disease, must be a mutated gene. Only the maximum for complex diseases is 30%. Most of those come from other factors.
Let's talk a little bit about something called epigenetics. Have any of you written stories about that or even heard of the phrase epigenetics? A little bit. So
okay.
You want to take that one on, Bruce?
I can certainly take that
one.
That's
a tough one to explain.
So genetics is deals with the linear sequence of the DNA molecule, so the letters of the genetic code. And when you change one of those letters, you have the possibility to change whether a gene is expressed or not, or to change the structure of a protein. A classic example would be sickle cell anemia. You change one protein, one amino acid in hemoglobin, and it causes the cells to fold up. Okay? So there are many such diseases. It turns out that most human disease is not associated with mutations in single genes. So epigenetics means on top of. So epigenetics is a layer of control that sits on top of the sequence of the genes. And whether you can think about it simplistically as you could consider a gene on and off just like a light switch. You turn the switch on, you turn the switch off. But now imagine that that light switch is in a room with a door. Okay, and you're outside the room. So in order to access the light switch, you have to open the door. So you can think of epigenetics that way, that it either opens or closes the door that allows you to turn the gene on or off. So epigenetics can be affected by these environmental chemicals that we're talking about. Okay, so not only can they cause mutations in the sequence of the DNA, but they can cause long-lasting changes in whether the DNA is expressed or not. So if you think about it, if I mutate a gene and make it non-functional, that's one way to cause a disease. But if I turn it off so that it's not expressed but is otherwise completely normal, that's the same effect, right? In one case, the gene's not on. In the other case, it makes a broken protein. The end result is disease. So epigenetics is a factor that's only becoming widely appreciated in the last 5 to 10 years as being responsible for health and disease.
Are there certain chemicals that we think have that effect?
There are a variety of chemicals. Probably it's been most elegantly shown by Michael Skinner at Washington State University, shown it with a fungicide called vinclozolin. And when he treats rats with vinclozolin, those effects he now has in the fifth generation after exposure. And there are no mutations. Right. This has not caused a mutation in DNA that's heritable. This has caused a change in the expression pattern of the genes, but without mutating them.
So basically, you could have a grandmother who's exposed to something, and you could have effects yourself because it crosses generations. I mean, it just stays with each generation.
So there are these famous studies from the region of Sweden called Uvercalix, which was on the cover of Time maybe a year or two ago. And it was shown in this study that the longevity of the current generation, or their chances of dying from cardiovascular disease, could be directly traced to what the paternal grandparents ate when they were 8 to 12 years old. Okay, and it actually turns out that if they ate well when they're 8 to 12 years old, so if their food was abundant and they ate a lot, that decreased the longevity of their grandchildren. This is a very sobering thought. So it's not just what we do to ourselves. Mm. It's what we can do to our entire lineage thereafter.
So talking about leaving a legacy for your grandchildren, usually you're talking about protecting forests or something like that.
Yeah.
Well, it also, you know, it's what you eat, it's what you're exposed to, it's what you breathe. That's also something you're leaving a legacy for future generations. Like I said, in the old days, we were talking about carcinogens, and that was difficult enough to cover. And now we're dealing with hormone disruptors and issues like obesity and epigenetics, and it just gets more and more complicated because the science improves.
Well, nature's complicated.
Right. Anything else you want to say before we go to some questions from the audience?
No, I think questions are the most fun part.
Okay, good.
I guess one thing that's common with
Mm-hmm. The question was that we want some discussion of pathways. How do we get exposed?
You mean where do carcinogens come from in our life? So which pathways are disrupted?
I think he means paths of exposure.
Ah, okay. So, well, you're exposed to all sorts of chemicals in the air, in the water, in the food that you eat. You know, some of these are toxic chemicals that are regulated to particular levels, and others of them are not. There's a variety of things that we add to the environment. So how do those chemicals cause cancer?
What do you consume
How
well, it's sort of
everything?
Like what do you consume that doesn't have it is what it comes across to. Well, I mean, it depends on the contaminant. What we talked about, the organochlorines, those are the PCBs, the DDT that are now banned. They're still in the food webs. They're in the food supply, and they take centuries probably to break down.
It's very hard to get a handle on it. So bisphenol A, a topic that we spent at the NTP a lot of time looking into a few years ago, we did this evaluation. Oh, it's food packaging. It's oral exposure. Everybody knows that. So we did our evaluation, and then reports come out. Oh, medical devices in hospital. oh, cash had your receipts. And so what we realized is that we thought we had a good handle on exposure, but we didn't really have. Bruce's, the Oregon Attends, there was a paper that came out at the end of 2010, I think, that found higher than expected levels in household settings.
Yes,
and so I talked
does.
To the author, and they said, you know, Gucci bags, wallpaper. So even this chemical that, you know, we've thought there should be not much exposure to because it's been phased out, maybe there's more than we thought. So it's very hard, even when you think you know the pathways, to really have confidence that you can eliminate.
Well, I know with PBDEs, the flame retardants that are found in furnishings and electronics and that kind of thing, the first thought were, well, it probably acts like the old contaminants and it's probably in the food supply. But now it seems like it's in the dust. So it's in household dust. It's coming out of couch cushions and that type of thing.
Indoor air quality in homes. I don't think enough study been done in this area, particularly now that we're sealing our homes. And so we have the formaldehyde and wood, you know, the artificial wood and the chemicals in our carpet and the Chinese drywall incident.
Sure.
You know.
The questions about indoor air quality?
So it's not something that we're studying, but I think that it's becoming widely appreciated that that's an issue that has to be dealt with. And you're right, buttoning up our homes really tightly to make them energy efficient, now there's no fresh air coming in. So that needs to be addressed.
I think the California Air Resources Board has done studies and said most of your exposure to air pollutants is indoor, not outdoor.
Probably, yeah.
And in the car setting.
Inside cars. Question over here?
Yeah, you mentioned a handout. Where is it?
Well, I only had 20 copies because you guys filled the room. The most I could manage in the hotel today. So you might have to share
anyone.
Some. But I also gave out a yellow pad with so you could write your name on it, and I'll email it to everybody.
Okay.
So if you didn't get a handout or if you want more information from them.
And the handout of mine is sort of an abbreviated version of a longer one.
Only two pages.
Really, interested in more detail, then
please put your name on that, and I'll make sure you get everything from them. Okay? The question was about medical researchers and physicians. How aware of these issues are they?
Less than they ought to be, to be very honest.
Obstetricians should be aware of this, but a lot of them aren't.
So obstetricians and pediatricians are the audience we would really like to make very aware of the study. And actually, I was at Colby College last week at a meeting which they put on, and the guy who spoke before me was the person who ran the pediatric obesity program in Maine, and he was very skeptical about chemicals till after he heard the talk, and now he wants to know what kind of research he can do to help solve the problem. It's a problem of information in this country. So up until a few years ago, before the Endocrine Society statement on endocrine disruptors came out, at least half of visiting people. So we host seminars at our university, most do, and people come by and you talk to them. And I say we work on endocrine disruptors, and half of them said, endocrine disruptors, what's that?
Yeah.
And if you go to Japan, I swear to you, every taxi driver in Japan knows what is an endocrine disruptor and that it's important to avoid them. I'm quite serious about that.
This has been an issue around for 20 years, and most people are not familiar with it or don't understand it.
How is it in Japan that every taxi driver knows about that?
Because there's lots of information being put out. So the Japanese government came to believe that it was a big issue, and they threw huge money into it in the early 2000s.
Mm-hmm. And the physicians in this country are barely aware of mercury, which has been a problem for decades, much less endocrine disruptors. Question back there? Questions about particulate matter and obesity?
Chris, you want to handle that? Probably.
Yeah. I found that there were fewer studies than I thought there were out there. We didn't include them as sort of a theme in the workshop. I think there might be about five or so. But I think that for me, the interesting part was not just sort of diabetes, but also metabolic syndrome. So when you think about sort of the inflammatory pathways that we know particulate matter is associated with, then I think that I know that there are a few people, and I certainly support that, trying to look into more of the association with metabolic disorders.
question about the dose levels and effects in either animals or humans is what you're talking about?
All variations. So clearly when we're sort of summarizing the human studies, those are, it can be relevant for a certain highly exposed population, but a lot of those studies are also general population studies. So there you have sort of the built-in relevance. In the animal models, the experimental studies of nicotine, they tended to try to give the pregnant animal an amount of nicotine that a heavy smoker might see, so try to be environmentally relevant. Studies on bisphenol A were suggestive of effects on glucose homeostasis and insulin sensitivity were low, very low doses. Organophosphate pesticides in the animal studies, high doses in old literature, and I think that that's where you're going to see sort of the research evolve to try to better understand the effects at lower doses.
But these are repeated doses. These are one dose.
Well, in the human, it's just a blood level or a fat level, so it's just what you're carrying in your body. And if you're carrying PCBs in your body, they've been banned for decades, so it's a pretty low level of exposure. So if they find any kind of correlation to this, that's by nature a pretty low level.
Right? So with the animal studies, mm-hmm. it's becoming more appreciated recently. It's still a bit controversial, but I think the vast majority of working scientists believe that low doses can have an effect. And it wasn't uncommon that no one was testing low doses a few years ago. You'd say, okay, we don't see an effect at one part per million, therefore we won't continue testing. And it turns out with endocrine disrupting chemicals, if you continue testing at lower doses, you will see effects. So tributyl tin, we're working at parts per billion in our animal models. PPB, parts per billion.
And it is kind of counterintuitive. You don't have a hormonal effect at the high level. You do at a low level. And I'm not sure exactly why that happens in an animal model, but it seems to be happening. And so at very low levels, you could have hormone-disrupting effects, whereas if you have high exposure, it triggers a different effect.
There's lots of reasons why that is. The way that the receptors that we're talking about, the estrogen receptor, testosterone receptor work, they're designed to act at very low levels of hormones. So for the women in the audience, your estrogen receptor is fully saturated at one part per billion estradiol. It can't be activated anymore. Okay? So the receptors are designed to be sensitive at very low levels. As you increase the level, the body still needs to be able to respond. So more receptors will get made. Or metabolism will get kicked in to degrade the chemical because the levels are too high. So if you give high doses of a chemical that activates the receptor, you may see no effect at all because you've turned metabolism on and the chemical is cleared as fast as you get it.
Well, and I'll do a little bit of history here about how we know that a little bit extra of a hormone isn't a good thing prenatally. There was a pharmaceutical called DES in the 40s, 50s. That pregnant women were given, and now we have what's called DES daughters, and we probably have DES granddaughters. They have elevated cancer risks and endometriosis and all these things because they got a little bit too much estrogen in the womb. Mm-hmm. And so then when it was discovered that some of these environmental chemicals can act like estrogen or block androgens, which are the male hormones, it triggered something because we have that model of that pharmaceutical called DES, knowing what the possible effects could be. I have to say that the USGS press office is terrific. You know, they'll answer your phone calls, they give you what you need, their data is all open. I did a story, like I said, on trace elements in private water wells, and I had maps, and I had everything that I needed. And all you guys could find, somebody asked a question about localizing this story. Well, look at one of those maps and see where the arsenic is, or see where the manganese is, or see where VOCs are in your water. And then you can take those maps and you can do a story on some of these things that we're talking about. I highly recommend talking to USGS.
There's also another local angle that I think is less widely appreciated than it might be, and that's water reuse. So the guy from Arizona, I spoke last year in Prescott, Arizona, at a conference of the Citizens Water Advisory Group who are trying to understand whether it's a good idea to be recharging the aquifer with wastewater from the sewage treatment plants. So we're running out of water. So the aquifers have to be replenished. What are we going to replenish them with? How much treatment is necessary, what level of hormone or even pharmaceuticals in the water are acceptable. And I can tell you that a lot of the water district people believe that the problem is that they're just too good at detecting the chemicals. that, you laugh, but in Costa Mesa, California, near where I live, that's the thing, that we're just too good at detecting the chemicals, and there's really not a problem. It's just that we're too good at detecting chemicals and causing people to be upset needlessly.
You could check in your water supply to see what pharmaceuticals might be in the wastewater and possibly in the drinking water, and you might be surprised. There's antidepressants in there and anticonvulsants. There's all kinds of chemicals. We should be a little happier, I suppose. Very low levels. I mean, we're talking parts per trillion, but that's what most drugs are anyway.
No, certainly not.
No.
What I'm saying is, when the chemicals are tested, so Chris, correct me if I'm wrong, traditional toxicology start with a colossal dose of a chemical that kills everything, and you titrate down, and you figure out the dose that kills half the animals, and that's the LD50, and you go down, down, down until you don't see any effect at all, and that's called the no observed effect level. And then based on the chemical and the risk, there's a safety factor that's applied to that, and then they say, okay.
Just below this, everything's fine.
Exactly. But the reality is, if you test lower, you may see effects. Bisphenol A is an absolutely classic example. At the lower that you go, if you do the experiments carefully, you will see effects. That doesn't mean you did a bad thing by getting rid of your BPA, right?
High effects can have a totally
quite a good
different
thing.
I mean, high doses can have a totally different effect
than
low doses.
Yeah, I think it's not so much that the high dose doesn't have an effect. It has a different constellation of effects.
Making any difference.
Well, you are.
Well, and with fetuses, often the most sensitive endpoint, which means where you would find effects at low doses, are neurodevelopmental effects. Often cases you see changes in IQs, and they could be very subtle. The mother would never know. But there's been many studies, especially with mercury, which would show reduced IQ from exposure.
Okay, so the advice that I tried to give, and so I had a little controversy with the guy in Maine, because I said that it's a good idea to reduce your exposure insofar as you're able, right, as you're financially and physically able, reduce your exposure to all kinds of chemicals in the environment. Try to eat organic if you can. It's expensive, so insofar as you're able to afford it, you eat organic. Filter your water. I have to say this, you need to minimize plastic in your life. And I can't tell you the magnitude of the risk from these chemicals. We know there's a risk. I can't tell you what is the possibility that your child will have a developmental problem as a result of exposure. But I can tell you categorically that there is no benefit whatsoever to these chemicals in your environment. So if there's a risk and there's no benefit, why would you not get rid of it? And I think that's the message we need to get to obstetricians and pediatricians, is minimize the exposure. It's the best thing you can do.
In many cases, it's the advice is eat low on food webs.
Well,
you can't always do, but I spend a lot of time in the Arctic where everything they eat is high on food chains. Mm-hmm. So they're the most exposed population on Earth to some of these contaminants we're talking about, which is definitely counterintuitive. The question's about some populations with high numbers of males. High numbers of males, did you say?
Low numbers of males.
That's what I thought it was, right. Mm-hmm. And there's a population in Canada where that's been pretty well studied.
Well, for me, it's sort of been a pet issue that's been sort of floating around in my head for a while. I haven't done sort of, when NTP looks at something, we tend to do sort of a systematic search of it. And from that perspective, I haven't done a systematic assessment of that literature, but I know that it exists, and I think it's interesting, and I'd like to look at it.
And I think they're talking about PAH's exposure in that one community in Canada, which are industrial carcinogens that are put into the air, and they might have some hormonal.
And I also think some of the endocrine literature, there's a suggestion that maybe there's some sort of disproportionate sensitivity.
What was the name of the community?
I'm trying to think of the community in Canada. It's eastern Canada.
So also one of the very well-described results of the Seveso PCB exposure that happened in the 70s, the factory exploded
Italy?
In Seveso, Italy, and those people have been followed for all these years. So one of the very striking observations is that there's a probably half as many males born as would be expected in the offspring of males who were exposed. Okay, so that their descendants are disproportionately female. And that's probably 50%.
Are there any animal studies that back that up? Is there increased numbers of females when during some
I don't know. I don't know that literature, but I'm sure it's out there.
I've never actually seen data on that.
I've seen bits, but I haven't looked at it systematically.
Question was what about some of the worst offenders?
The issue of mixtures is a very real and important one because it's only in the laboratory that we're exposed to single chemicals. Right, in the environment, we're exposed to mixtures of chemicals that may have additive, that may have synergistic effects. You can even imagine they might cancel each other's effects in some cases. So that is starting to be done. NIEHS is trying to get a handle on how should we study the effects of mixtures, how best to do it so that the data which come from the studies is the most interpretable. Hmm. As for what chemicals aren't widely known, with regard to diabetes and obesity, the field is so very young. The field of chemicals and obesity, basically, I started 6 years ago. So it's an extremely young field. So I think in the next 2-3 years, you will start to see more. Many of them will be our usual bad actors. Mm-hmm. Bisphenol A is already cropping up. Phthalates are likely to be involved.
Cadmium.
So things that have estrogenic effects, if you give an exposure early in life, those will make the animals predisposed to get fat later. Where estrogens later in life give the opposite effect. Mm-hmm. They will make you less likely to get fat. They'll make you leaner. That's why we give estrogens to cattle, so that they build lean muscle mass.
There are more and more studies that are looking at multiple contaminants. I know some Parkinson's studies with animal models have combined a couple mm-hmm. pesticides, and they've seen an effect when they're combined, and they don't see an effect on when they're on their own.
Okay,
the Gucci bag connection?
I don't know if you'll find that in the published paper, but there was this paper that came out, I think it was December 2010, that looked at organotins in a household setting. And they looked in wallpaper, and they looked in maybe shower mm-hmm. curtains. And so anyway, I talked to the corresponding author, and you know, just talking about sort of how this was sort of unexpected to find these levels. And I can't pronounce his first name, but everybody calls him Cannon.
Oh, that's the guy from the New York Department of Public Health. Yeah.
Oh.
So organotins are heat stabilizers in polyvinyl chloride plastics. So that sounds like a big name, polyvinyl chloride. So what are polyvinyl chloride plastics? So that's basically water pipes, for one. So the PVC water pipes. Food packaging. So shrink film. A lot of that is PVC. The plastic blinds, you know, you have some vertical blinds in your house. So these things all, you know, crumble and get dusty. Paints have, many paints have organotins to keep them from growing fungus. So it's used as a fungicide. So this stuff crumbles into dust and gets in your house. It's not off-gassing. It's actually physically crumbling. It's not volatile.
So it gets into the dust.
And then who's crawling around the floor getting exposed to the stuff?
Toddlers are the most highly exposed. When, I'll repeat the question. What types of products might people be concerned about when it comes to things that might have an effect on diabetes?
Chris, you want to do that? Or you?
Well, I mean, I think so. A lot of what we looked at were sort of the known bad actors. So you have arsenic, you have cadmium, you have maternal smoking. So in that sense, I think it's sort of people already know, recognize those as being bad actors. And so,
even when you say that, I highly doubt the lay audience knows how to translate it. So how do you translate that?
Like arsenic could be in their drinking water, and their drinking water supplier should have water quality reports they issue, and you could look under that and see if there's arsenic.
Or if you live near a Superfund site, then the expectation you'd probably have higher exposure levels.
If you're fishing someplace, find out if there's fish advisories in that particular river or lake.
I'm going to be controversial because that's what I do. This is a bang for the buck issue, right? So it's a good thing to avoid all these chemicals as much as possible. A better thing might be to avoid all kinds of, sugar-sweetened beverages. High fructose corn syrup, it's everywhere. We consume a lot of it. We ought to consume less. And then that interacts with these chemicals. So, for example, if I've given an animal, when I give our animals tributyltin, they're predisposed now to gain weight. If you give them dietary components that will make them fat, they get fatter. Okay, so these factors are not, they don't exist in isolation. Many factors contribute a little bit. Did that help?
So what proportion would you attribute to epigenetic proportion?
Yeah, that's absolutely impossible to estimate. But if we look at, you know, overall disease patterns in humans, if maximum of 30% of them have can be traced to genetics, either we're very bad geneticists or there's other components. So the environment, lifestyle, epigenetic factors.
Right, but lifestyle, and environment are often, they can be distinct. You know, lifestyle is I'm eating too much and not
right.
exercising enough. Epigenetics is a whole different issue.
That's true.
I mean, I know you, if you can't give me a ratio, you can at least give me a sense of weighting them, you know.
Remember we talked about 30% don't have anything to do with body weight.
But
so that's, it could be somewhere within that 30% or
so it could be estimated for diabetes. I don't think it can be estimated for obesity because we simply don't know enough yet.
But for diabetes, I mean, is it a 2-to-1 thing more diet and vegetables?
It's really impossible to estimate right now. But I think one of the ways that we're looking at it is just when you think about the huge numbers of people affected, even if it is ultimately a relatively small contribution, it still has, you know, it's potentially a preventable factor, a preventable risk factor if we can reduce exposure. And if we can do anything to sort of chip away at the sheer numbers, then it can have a lot of public health impact, even if it's not the main factor.
Well, one question I've had, do any of these factors, because this science is fairly new, are regulators looking into this at all when they decide whether to, you know, extend the permit of a pesticide or to, when TSCA kicks in, the Toxic Substance Control Act? This is not even in the realm of regulators right now, right?
Yes, I'll answer that because Chris probably has constraints on what she's allowed to say.
Thank you.
The bar is set so very high for the EPA. So the Toxic Substances Control Act sets the bar, the standard of proof, so very high, it's almost impossible for them to label anything that we very obviously know is problematic as having to come off the market. And that is that's being debated right now in Washington, whether that should be changed and whether the burden of proof should be shifted. Why do I have to prove that a chemical is harmful in order to get it off the market? Why shouldn't the manufacturer have to prove that it's safe before it goes onto the market?
There's a law in Europe, and it's called REACH, that has gone far beyond what TSCA has in this country as far as looking at the hazards of chemicals and trying to get at that, because you're pretty much, TSCA hasn't banned a chemical since asbestos, I think, in 1989, and that was thrown out of court because the judge said you didn't have enough evidence. Asbestos is a clear carcinogen, so if they couldn't ban that one, what are they going to do for things like BPA, where it isn't as clear? I don't think that's true, because REACH has just kicked into gear on that. What they found is that there's some agencies in Europe that deal with food safety, and they're very, you know, they're just looking at one particular type of thing. So I don't think any of these compounds that we're talking about, like PBDEs, have gone through the REACH.
So when you say Europe, are you talking about the European Commission?
Yeah.
Okay, so that's not so different from EPA. I mean, it has a broader mandate. How do I say this delicately? There's so much money here involved that there's a large amount of pressure applied by the groups that manufacture substances to make it very difficult to have them regulated. So there's that's becoming more recognized, and it's becoming more recognized around the world. So one of the ways that some of us in the community are working to change that is by linking the emerging field of green chemistry with environmental health sciences. So there's a small but growing number of people, of chemists, who want to make products that are inherently safe by design. So they're made without toxic solvents. They're made from renewable feedstocks. There's 12 principles of green chemistry, and I won't enumerate them all. But the goal is to make products that are safe by design. So Chris and I are both part of this group that's connected green chemists with toxicologists and environmental health professionals because, you know, the American Chemistry Council and the EPA and many groups will tell you it's difficult, if not impossible, to screen for endocrine-disrupting effects. And I guarantee you it's not difficult or impossible. So we're trying to connect the people making the chemicals with the ability to test early on. So you're making new chemicals and you have, let's say, you have 12 of them. Some of those are likely to be problematic, and you'd like to know before you have too much invested in their development which ones to get rid of and which ones to focus on. So the belief is that by facilitating the design of safe chemicals from the beginning, we will, without regulating them, they'll just disappear from the marketplace because better alternatives will exist. Doesn't mean that we shouldn't try to regulate them, but that doesn't seem to be working very well. Yes.
The questions about animal models and whether they're still in use.
Chris, you want to go?
Well, it's actually it's sort of a growing portion of the National Toxicology Program portfolio to try to, reduce, refine our animal models. And so for us, we have a high throughput screening system that's been developed generating data. But what's happening is people sort of need to have some context. How do sort of the high throughput signals align with animal models and human studies? And so I think what's going to happen in the short term is that we're going to have to sort of try to conduct additional animal studies to try to piece those pieces together. But the long-term goal is that when we find out that there are these more that we can use the in vitro or high throughput signals to try to predict, then we want to. Everybody wants that. It's just we have to sort of build up the data set so we can feel public health protective about using the data.
More questions in the back?
Well, let me also finish comment on that. So it's a good idea to reduce the number of animals that we use for testing things. And we have a mandate to do that, right, to reduce the number of animals, to not use more than we need, to justify the use of animals. But you also need to consider that a cell in culture or a computer model is not the same thing as a cell inside an organ in your body. So you can learn a lot by treating cells. We do that. We work with stem cells. So we're screening for chemical obesogens by looking at their effect on stem cells. Ultimately, you need to check, does this make an animal fat? Will it likely to make a human fat? So in vitro studies and computer models are useful, and we use them as much as possible because we don't like to have lots and lots of animals for many reasons. One, you don't like to kill things needlessly, and secondly, it's very expensive to keep animals, and research dollars are limited. So the more animals I use, the less other experiments I can do. So I really want to use the minimum number possible to get an answer that's definitive. And we all do that.
And just one more comment on that. So actually, one of sort of the direct research follow-up for the NTP from this workshop is really targeted at the high-throughput screening level and in vitro level data.
Good question. Question about infertility and exposures?
It's not a field I know anything about, Chris.
Well, yeah, it's not something I've dealt with recently. I mean, certainly there are studies linking, but I think in terms of collectively trying to sort of talk about the overall contribution of environmental chemicals to infertility, I don't think we have a good handle on it. And it's also one of when you talk about sort of the hardships of trying to look at this in clinical settings, I mean, when presented with infertility, what doctor asks a woman or a man about sort of their chemical exposures?
It's just not on the radar.
And the 12
minutes
I have.
It's not on the medical radar.
So, yeah. Right.
We just did a story at Environmental Health News about in vitro fertilization and some of the studies which are linking lower success rates in IVF and BPA and hexachlorobenzene, which was a pesticide. So there have been some studies looking at fertility rates.
Yeah, and actually, yeah, we're talking about human data. I mean, there's certainly lots of animal data to show that if you give a certain chemical, then the animals can become infertile.
When I said something about neurodevelopmental effects being sometimes the most sensitive, probably another most sensitive is the whole issue of reproduction. questions about exposure to some of these chemicals like PCBs through breast milk. And the same types of things you're talking about for dolphins, they've seen in polar bears in the Arctic because they're very highly exposed to PCBs through mother's milk.
And orcas.
Yep, and orcas. Some of the most highly exposed creatures on Earth are orcas in the Pacific Northwest.
So there are lots of studies on levels of chemicals in breast milk. I think that there are many fewer studies on what is the effect on the children of those moms. That's something that, probably will come out of the, you know about the National Children's Study, right? So I think that's the kind of, information that the National Children's Study ought to be very good at providing. It'll take some years, but to do large studies with people are very, very expensive, but they have to be done.
And I, most of the experts I talk to talk more about prenatal effects than effects from breast milk because the fetus is more sensitive than the infant. But you might want to address that.
I think you're right. That's where sort of the research is. But I think it's also true that we just don't have a lot of information on sort of long-term health effects aside from the literature on some of the persistent pollutants.
Especially for wildlife. We have some wildlife data. We don't have a lot of human data for that. Can you repeat the question, whoever answers it to?
Okay, so the question was, what do we know about the effect of the microbiome on obesity, diabetes, and potentially other things, and what do we know about the effect of chemicals on that? So if the study of environmental chemicals on obesity is a young field, the study of the microbiome is prenatal. I mean, it's really, it's an extraordinarily fascinating field. I mean, you can take the gut bacteria from obese mice and put those gut bacteria into mice that don't have any, and they will get fat. And you can do the opposite. You can take bacteria from lean mice, and they will not get fat. So can the nature of the bacteria growing, not just in your gut, but how about your lungs? So there's a microbiome in your lungs as well. Does it have anything to do with asthma and COPD? We know almost nothing about that, and I think that we're going to learn a lot in the next 10, 15 years as that field becomes more studied.
It's definitely a hot topic.
Yeah. Do you want to?
I haven't seen any study on.
So, you probably know that there was this study from England suggesting a link between thimerosal and vaccines, and that was retracted, and the guy was drummed out of science. It was completely fabricated. Having said that, it is an extraordinarily bad idea to put mercury in anything. Why would you do it? And it's just one of those things that's just absolutely duh. Why would you do that to begin with?
I think it's been eliminated from all, if not.
I certainly hope so.
A flu shot.
I mean, just a bad idea. Again, little benefit and demonstrated risk. No reason to do it.
One thing we haven't talked about when it comes to environmental health is one that's often forgotten is just the plain old air pollution that we're dealing with. And we're from Southern California, so we hear more about it, I think, than most of the public does. But one of the most well-proven correlations is particulate matter in the air and increases in deaths and diseases and hospitalizations from cardiovascular disease and from respiratory diseases. It's been well proven around the world when you increase fine particles in the air, and these particles come from vehicles as well as industry, you have an increase in deaths and sicknesses. So that's something you could all go to your local community, and fine particle monitoring is mandated by the EPA in most communities now. You could see what your fine particle data is showing, where the hot spots are, and you could do a story on all this international data which shows that it increases this, and you could talk to emergency room doctors and that type of thing. That's just a very good story that anybody basically could do. Question about perchlorate?
Yeah.
I think EPA has announced their intention to regulate.
Right.
They haven't set a level, but they've announced their intention.
Exactly.
Right.
Well, they actually announced they would set no standard at first, and then they retracted that and said, now we're probably going to set a standard. So,
I can tell you who you want to talk to. The person you want to talk to is Tom Zeller at the University of Massachusetts, Zoeller.
Zeller.
Zeller. Zoeller, Tom Zoeller.
Yeah, and it's
UMass,
also
Amherst.
It's an interesting interplay because you also probably have sort of nutritional elements in terms of if a person is iodine deficient, is that being a modifying factor? So I know that's one of the angles that people have been looking at too.
Yeah, there was some thought that rather than regulate perchlorate, you could just add iodine to the diet. Isn't that the National Academies put out a report saying that, which is real controversial? Okay, we know that there's an environmental contaminant, but the easiest and cheapest way to deal with it is to put something in your diet.
Yeah, and
it's rubbed a lot of people wrong.
And I know that there are also, people think about taking supplements, which could be one remedy, except that I think there was a study that came out recently that, what's advertised as being a supplement isn't really necessarily what's in that supplement.
University of Massachusetts.
Massachusetts. And perchlorate, no, it hasn't gone away. And for those of you unfamiliar with that one, it's mostly a defense industry. It's a component of rocket fuel, right? And it has fireworks and some. It's basically something you use in explosives, which isn't a good thing to have in your milk supply or your water supply.
So what I think, or what I hope I said, is that that's an emerging controversy. So we need to understand that. I mean, in Orange County, so we're actually recharging the aquifer with wastewater. But it's actually been demonstrated that that wastewater is pristine. It's basically laboratory-grade, ultra-purified water that's going back into the aquifer. That was the only way that it was allowed.
It's so highly treated in that Orange County plant.
Maybe the other would work.
So that can be done. You can do that. The question is, if you're going to do it on a small scale, let's say you're going to do it in your house. You have, a mountain cabin somewhere you want totally off the grid. That's fine. That technology exists, but you need to monitor, right? So how will you know when the filters aren't working well anymore? So in the municipality, of course, you can know that. That's tested regularly and tested and monitored. And you can tell as soon as certain chemicals that are symptomatic of a larger problem, as soon as those appear, the filters have to be changed. So if you were doing it in your cabin, you wouldn't have an easy way to know that.
But, even though municipalities test for a lot of things, there are no requirements for certain things, with the emerging contaminants like the pharmaceuticals and that type of things.
Yeah.
I know that some of them are doing some initial testing to see how much of, say, Prozac gets, past it. And they're finding that the filtration does remove a lot of it, but it doesn't often remove all of it. And the EPA doesn't require any of that testing at this point. It's also
estrogens are also tough to get out of the water. Mm-hmm. Sewage treatment does not degrade them. Right. Well, what I said was you should do that to the extent that you're able. So in an ideal world, you would like to do that. But we don't live in an ideal world, and we don't have unlimited money to live our lives. If you're going to build a new house, you don't have an unlimited budget. You'd probably, if your choice, you'd like to put stainless steel pipes in your house. How expensive would that be? But that would be the best. But then, the rest of what's the municipal water supply coming in? So there's lots of issues there. How can that be done?
Well, there's a whole movement called, I don't think you addressed this, called green chemistry, which deals with this. They want to have chemicals that don't persist. They don't want to have a lot of wasteful products. But it also has to be, an efficient process for industry, and it has to be an economically sound one, too. That's a principle of green chemistry, because it doesn't work if you just have something that's totally non-toxic, and it doesn't shampoo your hair well.
Luckily, you may not know this, the assistant administrator of the EPA, Paul Anastas, is one of the world's preeminent green chemists. So that's a really good thing. At least we hope it's a good thing if he stays for a while.
Yeah, he was one of the founding fathers of green chemistry.
So there are some biomonitoring studies. So you know about the Center for Disease Control's NHANES, the National Health and Nutrition Examination Study. So they're looking at, I looked at that list the other day, 200 or 300 chemicals. It's a pretty small and pretty focused list. And if there's 300, then 200 of them are PCBs. So there have been some small-scale studies. The Environmental Working Group did the personal toxome. They got 100 people or so to volunteer, and they tested 100 chemicals in the blood. It would be nice, and I agitate my friends at NIEHS always, that they need to establish a center for testing I would like to be able to send samples to a place that I know is good and say, can you test for these 50 compounds for me? The obesogens that we work on, no one's testing for. They're not being biomonitored. So we need to do that monitoring, and Chris is starting to do that with her Denmark group.
Yeah, and actually, so the NHANES, the CDC data, what you have is you have information on 250-ish chemicals, but you don't actually have on every person. They have to sort of, they split the samples out. But, you know, it's definitely a key issue for us. And so one of the areas that we're trying to get more data is a sort of a small pilot study to look at within the same individual as many chemicals as are on CD's list. Basically, it's only limited by how much blood and urine we can collect. But it's definitely an issue to try to sort of better understand within a person that complex mixture that they're seeing.
I've read some studies, and I can't think of what the contaminants are at this point, but there has been talk about, well, ADD.
Can either of you think of any particular?
I think the same as you. I mean, sort of maybe some of the ADD, but I haven't seen so much with sort of depression. A few things here and there, but I've maybe been a little bit surprised that that hasn't been more of a research question.
There are some Danish studies that are looking at the children of greenhouse workers. So if you imagine you're growing plants in a greenhouse, that's a contained environment, and they actually put a fair number of pesticides and all manner of chemicals. So there are some studies from the Technical University of Copenhagen, and they're looking at neurological effects in the offspring of women who were exposed in greenhouses. So that's the best data that I'm aware of. That's an area that we need to know more about.
Yeah, I haven't seen that much. I mean, there's been a lot of Parkinson's work and autism work, but I haven't seen
right. And
much
lead,
about,
but
yeah, lead.
Is, oh, well, mental illness equals genetic. Well, if it equals genetic, then isn't it possible to manipulate with epigenetics and chemicals?
Sure. And if it were genetic, we'd have figured it out already, to be perfectly honest.
It's not all
genetic. It were genetic, if it were all genetic, or if it were even mostly genetic, we would have figured it out by now. Oh, it's even worse than you think. So I was just in a meeting in Italy about a month ago, and I met a Finnish guy.
I need a drink.
And his father is a manager of a bottling plant. And he was complaining to his father about, you know, the kinds of chemicals in there. So the way that it works is when they injection mold those bottles, they're filled with the product while they're still hot.
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes. That's how, well, do I have personal knowledge? No. That's how he said that they're made, that they're formed and filled at the same time, within seconds.
I think we have time for one more question before we get kicked out.
Maybe it's kind of that we eat so much processed food now.
So is that happening with respect to obesity yet? No. Sure. We need to know a lot more than we know. I mean, in order to say this chemical contributes X percent to obesity or diabetes, we need to know much more about what's there, what are the effects, what are the mechanisms, and what's the relative risk. But as I said before, if the risk exists and the benefit is non-existent, it's pretty clear what you ought to do if you want to maximize your health. Right? You want to minimize exposure as much as is feasible for your lifestyle.
If any of you have thoughts on, okay, what has the media already written about these types of issues, I suggest that you go to my website, ehn.org, and there's a search box there. And if you type in diabetes, you're going to call up all the environmental health stories related to diabetes that have been written over the past 8 years or something like that. And it'll give you links to them. Here's examples of two of them that my staff has written. This one's about the big human study on BPA, which found a link to diabetes and heart disease. And here's one we wrote out of the Great Lakes about contaminants, PCBs especially, playing a role in diabetes. So if you're interested in, say, breast milk or whatever, you can type that in and find out what the media all over the world has written about that. So it's a great resource.
I don't know about Chris, but I'll be here until tomorrow, so I'm happy to answer questions of any of you that didn't have a chance.
Great. Thanks, our panel.